Welcome, everyone. I'm Stephen Roberts. This is Friday night's Kent's Look a Ball. We have a very good show tonight, very special show. I have Jillian with me. We just got finished off with her show not 6-7 minutes ago. And she did a reboot on her computer and jumped right back on. She's the one to set this show up, so I'm just going to introduce our guest. Tonight we have woman advocate and mother's advocate and a child advocate lawyer Barry Goldstein on. So welcome to the show, Barry. I'm gonna let Jill do a little bit more of a intro for you.
Okay, good to speak with you, Stephen.
Yeah, it's lovely to have you, Barry. Barry's an attorney from America who has been influenced very strongly by a lot of feminists. And feminist thought about the rights of women. And at the moment he's not an attorney because he actually took on a judge for being unfair, and so he's taken a year off. And so now he describes himself as no longer an attorney but a good guy. Isn't that what you call yourself? Anyway, you are a lovely guy, Barry, and you're very you're actually about to give a some seminars in Washington, D.C. at the University of Washington for... Is it Washington, D.C., Barry?
It's Washington, D.C., and it's George Washington University.
That's right, and it's on women's rights, and what else is it? Barry, tell us what you're up to, because you know better than any of us.
Okay, what we're talking about is the Battered Mothers Custody Conference. And this will be the 11th annual conference. It had been started in Albany by Dr. Mo Therese Hanna in 2004, and we've been doing it every year since. And this year we are doing it in the nation's capital. And so we are going to have some training and some programs, and then we're going to do some demonstrations and some lobbying. It's an opportunity to do a lot of things to try to reform the broken custody court system.
Well, you're absolutely right, and I don't think people really understand. Like, even only yesterday, I had a conversation with someone, and mind you, I live in Australia, in which I said, oh, the woman lost custody of the children, and the person said, oh, there must be some truth in it then. There must be something wrong with the mother. And I said, you have no, this woman's actually been through courts herself, and she knows how unjust they are. And I said, you've got to be joking. The system is corrupt, to just so badly corrupt. People lose their children all the time just because the judge is having a bad day, or they haven't got a clue what's going on, and the judges are just not trained, and the lawyers are not trained to recognize the needs of the children and to understand how these women, who really annoy me too sometimes, because they're so hysterical because they're losing their child. So they come across as mad. They don't realize that they're actually hysterical because they're losing the fruit of their womb, for want of a better word.
Well, you know, it's interesting. The U.S. Department of Justice put out a very important piece of research by Dr. Dan Saunders, and one of the points he made is that court professionals focus too much on the emotion and the anger of women, or out of proportion to what it means about their parenting. And so that's one of many mistakes that we see in the court system.
Yeah, that's true. And then another mistake that Judge Carlos Rozanski pointed out is that the courts, A, are not trained, right? They really have to. And he's a very important United Nations judge who's very pro children's rights. And he points out the incredible importance of training lawyers and judges to understand how the children need the lawyers and judges need to be trained, and they need to be trained to understand the needs of the children better and to understand the language of children better, because it's so important. Children just aren't getting a say. They're just being wiped over, and they're not being given a proper say or analyzed by proper psychologists.
Yes, I mean, it's been a big problem. And what the Saunders study was about was talking about the lack of proper training for not only judges, but also lawyers and evaluators. So one of the problems is that the courts have tended to rely on psychologists and psychiatrists who are experts in psychology and mental illness, but not in domestic violence. And since they don't understand domestic violence, you know, they focus on other less important issues, and they in turn miseducate the judges.
Yes. Yes, they. Would you like to extrapolate on that a little bit, Barry?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Would you like to say a bit more about that?
Yes, sure. What Saunders said was that court professionals need specific training about recognizing domestic violence, risk assessment, post-separation violence, and the impact of domestic violence on children. And, in fact, most of the professionals in the courts have not had that specific training. Lots of times they will have some kind of training in domestic violence, and often it includes misinformation like alienation theories and high conflict theories. But it's the worst of all worlds because they think they've had the training, so they don't seek help from genuine experts. And what Saunders found is that inadequately trained professionals tend to focus on the myth that women frequently make false allegations, on unscientific alienation theories, and the belief that mothers' attempts to protect their children from dangerous abusers are actually harming the children, and in turn they make recommendations that are harmful to the children. So when we see in Australia, in the United States, in Canada, all over the world, we see all these cases where the judges and the lawyers and the evaluators are focusing on the myth, are focusing on alienation theories, and don't know how to recognize true allegations of abuse, and so they keep getting it wrong. And that's what Saunders was saying, and it's really helpful to get that, because coming from the U.S. Department of Justice, it has a lot of credibility.
Right. Yep, makes sense. So once it comes from the Department of Justice, once again, it gets credibility, which is a bit of an oxymoron, isn't it? But that's how it is.
Yeah, they've actually been very helpful to us. There's been a real improvement. A couple of years ago, the Office on Violence Against Women, which is part of the Justice Department, organized a roundtable discussion in which they invited some of the leading experts in the United States. And I was one of the people who was part of that meeting. And we were able to provide information. And this information led the Justice Department to reach conclusions that the custody court system is not properly protecting battered mothers and children, and that there really is a need for reforms. And in fact, they recently released some technical grants to help state court systems to reform the practices that are working so poorly for children.
Yeah, well, let's hope they reform them. So that's what you'll be talking about at the conference, is it?
Yeah, it's one of the things. If you want, I can go through the plans for the conference, because we're really excited about it.
Mm-hmm. That'd be lovely. What would you just talk about what you'd like to talk about, because we you can use this as a promo and to inform people as well, because, you know, my mission is to just get the word out that lawyers and judges need re-educating, and that's the politest way to put it. Take it to its extreme, and there's pedophile rings, and there's all sorts of things going on there, and women are losing their children just absolutely willy-nilly. But not just that women are losing their children. Children are losing their mothers, and it's just tragic, and often to the perpetrator of domestic abuse. Yeah. Children are losing their mothers. So go on, Barry. What's the most exciting things that are going on at the conference at the moment?
Well, The first day on Friday, May 9th, which is the Friday before Mother's Day, we are going to have a special training for domestic violence advocates and mothers. And what we want to do is train the advocates to really help protect the mothers much more. So they're going to learn more about the recent research that supports protective mothers. They're going to learn how to make their community aware of the crisis in the custody court system, because, as you know, the media has really done a poor job of covering the scandal. And we've seen some examples where leaders of state coalitions or local DV shelters are interviewed by the media, and they have a perfect opportunity to mention the failure of the custody court system. In one case in Indiana, there was a custody dispute, and the father came to the daycare and shot the mother. You know, she survived, but only barely. And the state coalition director was interviewed and never mentioned that this is exactly what happens when the custody courts don't recognize domestic violence, and so they focus on other issues. And so we want to train staff and advocates to inform their community about the problem, because I think that if the public knew how often we're not protecting children, they would demand changes. So we have Kathleen Russell from the Center for Judicial Excellence, who does wonderful advocacy work and public relations work. And so she's going to do a training on that. Rita Smith, who is the executive director of the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence, and who they're co-sponsoring this. She's going to talk to advocates about how to interact with protective moms and help them through the system. And I will give some general information about, you know, the research. And then the second part of the training, we are going to train advocates to be expert witnesses. And we will give them a certificate at the end of the day. Because what the Saunders study did is they looked at judges, lawyers, evaluators, and advocates. And the ones who had the most expertise in the specific areas the courts need are the advocates. They're doing this work full time, and yet what has happened is that the courts have treated the other unqualified groups as if they were the experts. And what Saunders really recommends is a more multidisciplinary approach. And
yes, go on. That's right. So, this much I know, and Stephen Roberts knows a lot about this too. He's done a lot of listening to this, and I'd like you to comment, if you would, please, in a minute, Stephen.
I'm sorry.
I'll let him go ahead and continue a little bit, Jill.
Okay, go on.
We are hoping that by training advocates to be expert witnesses, that, number one, the courts will start to hear accurate information, and, number two, mothers will have access to experts that they can afford and who actually know what they're talking about. And so we think that that might really start to change the broken system.
Makes sense. Oddly enough, just knocked at my door is a battered mother. She's just come in. She's not here with a black eye. So I hope we're not getting any feedback. I've just put this on loudspeaker.
Barry.
Yeah, go on.
What I was going to say, Barry, yeah, there was a little bit of feedback there, Jill, but what I was going to say, Barry, is one big problem I see is getting around this parental alienation syndrome when it comes to, you know, sexual abuse and that, or physical abuse. Do you see some remedies? Anything in the future, or?
You know, we are making progress everywhere but in the courts. You know, several months ago, the DSM-5 came out, and that's the compendium of all legitimate mental health disorders that comes out from the American Psychiatric Association. And the abuser groups and the cottage industry of professionals that support them and make a lot of money by helping abusive fathers pressured the American Psychiatric Association to include parental alienation syndrome in this DSM-5, and it was rejected because there is no scientific research to justify it. It's a bogus theory that was concocted by Richard Gardner, not based on any research, but based on his personal beliefs and biases, which included many public statements to the effect that sex between adults and children is acceptable. And I suspect that if judges knew where it came from, they probably wouldn't want to be associated with it. And I think very often attorneys for mothers don't know that and don't tell the court that, and so it gets used in some really harmful ways. But what is also interesting, within the Saunders study, what they're saying is that deliberately false allegations by mothers occur less than 2% of the time, but the alienation theories are based on the false assumption that false allegations occur virtually all the time, and is like a tactic of mothers, and that's clearly wrong. The research shows it's wrong, and yet you see the abusers repeat that constantly, so much so that there's a lot of unqualified judges, lawyers, and evaluators who believe that.
Do you see any conspiracy in the picture, Barry? I've had a few of the so-called CPS whistleblowers on, a couple of them actually, and they seem to consistently say that there's a conspiracy within the CPS system and the Child Protective Services system, the family court system, to...
Well, you know, that's similar to, I often hear about corruption in the courts. And yes, it does happen. Although I think it's relatively
radio rare. The hosts are listening. And,
go ahead, Mary. She didn't
and the, you know, it, the, what the cottage industry is doing, these are the professionals who make a lot of money by helping abusive fathers. You'll see a bad guardian ad litem who's supposed to represent the children but actually is helping the father, then convince the court to appoint someone from the cottage industry as the evaluator, and then the court has no chance to find the right things. So that kind of conspiracy and improper actions does occur. But I really believe most of the time, I don't think judges want to hurt children deliberately. I think that the court system, from the start, has relied on unqualified mental health professionals. When I say unqualified, they're qualified to handle other types of cases that don't have to do with domestic violence, but they're not qualified to handle domestic violence cases. They don't consult with DV experts, and so they keep getting it wrong. So if you think about judges today, they've spent their entire careers listening to misinformation so that it's deeply ingrained. One of the first things that Saunders said in his study was that we now have a substantial body of scientific research that could be used to inform court decisions. The problem is that we didn't have that research when the modern domestic violence movement started, so the courts never got into the practice of looking to this research to help them make better decisions. So now we have the research, they're still not looking to it. Because if they did, if they started looking at Saunders and ACE and some of the other research, you know, they would make much better decisions. I hope that's the direction we're going to be going to, but we have a long way to go. And I think that the judges don't understand that when they try to silence mothers, when they refuse to listen, when they try to justify their mistakes, they really create the impression, you know, that there's corruption. And, you know, ethically, judges are required to avoid even the appearance of bias or impropriety. And I don't think they're thinking about that. I think they think that if they admit they made mistakes and they hurt children, it would undermine their credibility. But that what they're doing to cover it up really undermines their credibility much more.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. When Jill, they start covering it up is when they lose their credibility.
Jill, do you want to introduce Jagdeep again?
Barry, we have a lawyer with us from Australia, a young lawyer who actually did family law, and he's an all-around good guy just like you, and his name is Jag, and we thought Jag might like to come along and ask you some questions as well. But we thought before we do that, we might actually play The Promise by Olivia Newton-John with the dolphin song. Are you ready to segue now, Barry?
Are you there, Barry?
Yes.
Do you want to hear the dolphin song that Jill picked for you?
Yeah, me and Kaylee will listen.
Okay.
All right, I'll give a quick explanation. Well, actually, Barry, explain how you met Kaylee and who Kaylee is.
Well, I actually went on an excursion during a cruise, and it was to meet dolphins. It was, you know, a dolphin adventure. And what I've been telling everybody is that somebody told Kaylee, which is the name of the dolphin I met, about the work I do to protect children. And as soon as she heard that, she came right up and kissed me. And so we have a picture of Kaylee kissing me, because, of course, dolphins don't want children to be hurt either.
Absolutely perfect. Okay, well, let's play the song now, Stuart. Stephen Roberts, my beautiful friend.
All right, give me a few seconds here, Jill. I just need to get something.
And then we'll bring Jag in afterwards.
Okay. All right, how am I going to do this here? Hang on a second.
So listen for the dolphin noises, everybody. It begins with some dolphin noises. So that was the dolphin song by Olivia Newton-John. Which,
yeah, that was a good song, wasn't it, Jill?
It was a good song, Stephen. Why do you think it's appropriate, Stephen?
Because of the poster and the picture that was taken of Barry.
Well, I'm sure he would be smiling.
Yeah.
Where are we going now, Jill?
We'll let Jag ask Barry some questions, I think.
Well, you need to introduce Jagdeep.
You do first.
I'm having trouble here because I've got the speaker on loud and I'm worried about reverb because I have a guest here who's very interested. But the situation is Jag is a young 27-year-old Melbourne lawyer who has done family law. I beg your pardon?
You're too kind.
Are you older than young?
I'm 28. Not that far off.
Barry, meet Jag. Jag, introduce yourself to Barry.
Hi, Barry. How are you doing?
Okay, nice to meet you.
Very nice to meet you. I've been listening to you. I think you've got some very interesting things to say. I'm a solicitor in Victoria in Australia. I am young. That's true. I do general practice, and one of the areas of law to do practice in is family law. Now, my particular background is ethnically Indian or Punjabi, Northwest Indian, and there's quite a large migrant community from Punjab that has moved to Australia over the last, say, 10 years. And a lot of them are at the stage now where they've come in as international students, most probably, and now a lot of them have settled. They're all getting their permanent residency and citizenship sort of around about now, and then we've got the issue of them having children as well, and now, you know, the honeymoon periods are over, and you know, basically it's coming back to the issues that people have. I wanted to get a little bit of insight from you on your, I guess, on your take of things like family violence and, you know, the role of the community at large, not the legal community, not the lawyers and the judges, I guess, but you know, other people, your next door neighbour even, you know, your family, or if you don't have family here, just people that you know, people that you work with, people that possibly you study with if you're a student, and their role in family violence in both, I guess, in both capacities as people helping the situation and also people making the situation worse.
Well, you know, one of the things I would say about that is that the abuser groups are trying to make the problem out to be a dispute between men and women or mothers and fathers. But the reality is, this is a dispute between the vast majority of good men and women who don't want to see children hurt, and a small minority of the most extreme abusers who are willing to hurt children because they understand that's the best way to hurt mothers. And one of the other hats that I wear, I am a member of the National Organization for Men Against Sexism, which is called NOMAS. And one of the reasons I joined them is that we wanted to have male groups that would be supporting protective mothers and speaking out. Because as we've talked about on this program, most of the public isn't aware how often custody courts get contested custody wrong, how often they really destroy children's lives and punish good mothers. And so we need to get that out. We need people to know about that. And of course, the other thing that the general public can do is to help support mothers who are going through this. And when I say support, I mean, you know, being someone they can talk to, someone that, you know, they can get some help from. And so I think that's part of the role.
Yeah.
And we need to address, you come from a fairly patriarchal society in some ways, do you, Jag, or not? Explain that.
Well, I mean, I sort of do, but I mean, not really. It depends. I mean, I guess in terms of patriarchal society, you know, in everyday function of life outside of the home, yes, correct. Men definitely in Punjab, you know, run society as it appears. But if you look at the home is really run by the wife or the mother, the big matriarch, whoever it is. And in fact, it comes down to, especially if you look at the situation when a person gets married, for example, the bride will move to the groom's house and start living with his parents, and his mother will really be running the show. So it's not really a patriarchal society per se. I mean, it is if you're looking at, you know, who's in power in government, who's running the, you know, running the community and those things, but not in the home. Definitely in the home is that absolute flip side of that.
Say, Jack, it used to be that way here in America up until the, 1940s probably.
Until the 1940s?
Yes.
Okay. And I suspect that it would have been like that in many, many communities, many cultures across the world, because at the end of the day, I mean, who looks after the joint? You know, I mean, I remember growing up, my mum really was the one who knew what was going on. Dad was out working all the time, you know what I mean? So this is a commonplace sort of thing, you know, in most societies, if you go back in history, sort of at one point or another. But the question then arises that, I mean, empowerment of women is a great thing. But you see in many societies, the society, and especially the men, don't know how to handle empowered women. And that leads to problems. And it's not the woman being empowered that is the problem. It's the problem, I guess, that men don't know how to handle that. What are some of the things, Barry, that you think that, you know, can be done in the legal fraternity or in terms of maybe, you know, legislatively, that can possibly assist in that regard?
Well, let me talk about two things. One is gender bias, and the other is making safety and health of children the first priority instead of a lot of the other priorities. Yeah. And in the United States, 40 different states have had court-sponsored gender bias committees, and they have all found widespread gender bias against women, and particularly women litigants. And most often what happens is that women are given higher standards of proof. They are blamed for the actions of their abusers, and they're given less credibility. Right. And the thing about gender bias, and the same thing is true of sexism and racism and other oppressions, is that it's unconscious. You know, the court officials who engage in gender bias do that without realizing that they're doing it. But the problem is, if someone tells them they're doing it, you know, they often get very defensive and retaliatory, and that's a problem.
Which fits in with them thinking that they're not doing it. So them getting defensive, obviously, they really do feel that they're not doing it, even if they are. So you're right.
It's an unconscious reaction, because that's how we operate unconsciously.
Correct.
You know, you hit the nail on the head, and everybody goes into a deep fit of denial.
So let me give you an example, which I think tells the story really wonderfully. There's an article called "Evaluating the Evaluators," written by Lynn Hex Schaffran, and she talks about a new psychologist who was appointed to evaluate a young family. And she goes to the father's apartment, and it's a complete mess, no food in the refrigerator, and she writes, the father lives in a typical bachelor apartment. She goes to the mother's apartment, and the mother's apartment is a little messy, not as bad as the father's. There's food in the refrigerator, but not as much as would be preferred. And the evaluator writes, the mother lives in a messy apartment with inadequate food.
No,
and because she was a new evaluator, she had someone supervising her who said, "Hey, did you see what you just did?" And she couldn't believe the gender-biased way that she had handled it and quickly corrected it. So here you have, someone who was acting in perfect good faith, even a woman, but she was relying on stereotypes about what's expected of women. You know, we think that correctly that women have more training, more experience with child care and taking care of the home and all of that. So instead of treating that as an advantage for the woman, an advantage for the child, we try to make up for it by reducing the standards that we hold men to. And we do it without even realizing that we're doing it. And you know, that's the way a lot of it works. It isn't about people being bad, but it's about not being aware of how men's behavior, men's reactions can impact women, not being aware of the context of what we're talking about.
But is the answer to always have, you know, somebody watching the watchdog, you know, or somebody evaluating the evaluator? Is that the answer, basically double up on everything?
I think part of the answer is that judges and other leaders should be open to hearing when someone says that they're acting, you know, in a sexist way or a gender biased way. Instead of treating it as an attack, they should treat it as a gift, that you're sharing something with them that can help them do a better job, but they have to encourage people to tell them. The other thing they ought to do is stop periodically and think, how would they handle the same situation if the genders were reversed? And lots of times that would have helped them avoid making the mistake in the first place.
That's so true. That's just so true. Yeah.
Now, the other suggestion that I have, and we're trying to pass this in some of the states here in the U.S., and I would encourage you to do it in Australia and everything, everywhere else. What we want to do is we call it a Safe Child Act, and basically it says that when courts are deciding custody or visitation, the first priority should be the health and safety of children. And I think that sounds obvious, and many people will be surprised that that's not what we're doing. But it would be really hard for anyone to say that anything else other than the health and safety of children should be the first priority. But because we're focusing on other issues that are far less important to the well-being of children, that's why we're getting so many cases wrong.
Yeah. What happens, Barry, in Victoria anyway, or Australia, I can say, which happens, I guess, quite commonly, I mean, you can have an independent child's solicitor who will then go and engage, you know, a barrister for advocacy. And that person will act in the best interest of the child, but the best interests of the child are, of course, somewhat tied up with, you know, what the mother and the father, or in some cases even the grandparents, are actually doing. And there's one thing in Australia which is there is deemed to be shared parental responsibility, equal shared parental responsibility, which doesn't mean that we're talking about what you would refer to as custody, but definitely in terms of financially, you know, or even more than financially, you know, visiting the child or the child visiting the parent or whatever, you know. So there is the starting point is equal parenting responsibility, and it moves from there. Now, the which way it moves is normally by consent, because, you know, I would say something like 97% of family law matters are, you know, are determined by consent between the parties rather than by going to trial and actually going through the, you know, or going through the defended hearing stage, rather. So basically, the independent child's solicitor has a choice. They can choose to go with what the mother is saying. They can choose to, you know, go towards what the father is saying. The court will generally end up accepting, I guess, you know, a majority rules type approach in saying that if the independent child solicitor is on the same side as the father here, well, maybe that's right. Or alternatively, it's the same side as the mother here, then that's right. Now, I've seen that in my experience, when a mother and a father both start, you know, battling it out in court, and this is you might think that this is gender bias, but I'm being very, I'm trying to be very objective here and very clear in my approach, but I have found that the father normally comes with more money into the picture, therefore is more able to be rational rather than emotional because he can afford it. So the mother, who at that stage is normally newly a single mother, looking after at least a child, let's say, not getting very much money from the father in terms of child support, the child support, which is deemed to be the state-based calculated child support, is actually not very much. And if you can rig it by, you know, getting paid in cash and all these sort of things that people do, what ends up happening is the mother ends up trying to go to lawyers who are charging her exorbitant amounts of money for what they are doing is a very difficult task. That's why they charge that money. The father sits there and has the money and can come into negotiations cool, calm, collected, looking like the better person. And the independent child solicitor very often goes towards the father for that reason. So you do get a bias in the result. And I think a lot of it arises from this inequality in the initial negotiation stage of the parties. It's very difficult to combat that very difficult to level the playing field because, basically at the end of the day, the person who's got the higher likelihood of winning any case is the person who throws more money at it.
Well, I think you're making a really important point here in terms of the context. Most cases in this country, it's about 96% of the cases are settled more or less amicably. I suspect something very similar in Australia. Because the mother and father love the children, and even though they would both like more time with them, they're going to try to make the decision that will be best for the children. And, that makes sense. The problem that you have is it's about, as I said, about 4% of the cases that cannot be settled. They go, to trial and often well beyond that.
Yeah.
Now, the courts treat these as high conflict cases, by which they mean the mother and father are angry at each other and act out in ways that are harmful to the children. The reality is, what the research actually shows, is that these are overwhelmingly domestic violence cases in which the father is using and manipulating the courts to regain control over the mother who's trying to leave him. And that's where the courts make the mistake. Because those cases, they need to protect the mother and the child. There is really important new medical research called the ACE studies, and this comes from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, so again, a very credible source. And the bottom line is that children exposed to domestic violence, child abuse, and other traumas will have more illnesses, more injuries, not only as children, but also as adults, and they will have shorter lives. Now, it's hard to imagine anything that goes more to the well-being and the best interest of the child than avoiding that. So if the professionals understood the risks to the children, if they understood that these are really abuse cases, then they should be overwhelmingly favoring the safe mother rather than the abusive father. And I think one of the things I would really want to emphasize is that courts need to avoid a false equivalency between mothers and fathers. There may be specific cases where they are equivalent, but in most cases, children need their primary attachment figure, which is the parent who did most of the child care in the first 2 years of the child's life, more than the other parent. They need the safe parent more than the abusive one. And so there's shared practices that try to treat the mother and father the same when they're not the same. That kind of false equivalency leads to a lot of mistakes. And the last thing I want to say is that what is needed, because you're right about the financial, and it's even more so in domestic violence cases, because typically abusers control the finances as they control everything else, and the court system has to have a way to make the father pay some of the mother's expenses so you can level the playing field.
Yeah, well, we do have that.
Face it, Jag. Our system's completely the same. It's just so mucked up.
Jill, I'll give you an example. First of all, a lot of practitioners in family law have their head up their ass. They don't know what they're doing. Because family law is one of those fields that you make money. You make a lot of money for doing not that much work actually, but it's work which is very taxing on you because it's hard to do. Because you're sitting in a room talking to a mother or a father or whoever, a person in a relationship who's just come out of it, who's emotionally screwed up, fragmented, trying to get you to do what they want rather than what should be done, but that's fair enough. As a lawyer, you have to deal with that. And it's totally different to the situation when someone says, I've got a contract and such owes me this many thousand dollars, now go and sue him. Totally different.
Okay, I want Barry to comment now. I don't want you to give long comments, if that's possible.
Just hear me out. Basically, you've got this issue where people legal practitioners in that stage will say, well, I will do this work because it's emotionally taxing on me and takes a lot of time to do very little, I'm going to charge more, so they do. That makes it harder in the beginning. And a lot of them actually don't know what they're doing anyway. So a lot of lawyers who have failing practices will go and do family law because they know that it's a good way to make money. Now, there is something called a barrow order, which is something sounds funny when you actually say barrow order, but anyway, it's a barrow is the case. It's an order which allows a practitioner or a party, a litigant, to request an order from the court that the other party pay them some money so they can fight their legal case. Do you get it? So the wife can say to the husband, I want some money so I can take you to court, and the court will allow it. But a lot of lawyers don't get them because it's very specific the way that you have to apply for these things, and a lot of them don't know what they're doing. And the ones that do know what they're doing are the ones that are really going to charge you a lot of money because they're specialists in that field. And in Australia, we have an accredited specialisation scheme whereby you're only allowed to say you're a specialist if you're an accredited specialist, and then you charge more because you can call yourself an accredited specialist. So they're the ones that know more about these sort of things. And if you go to them, well, you know that you're paying more. You probably don't need money from the other party because you've got it yourself. So it's one of those things that the tools are there. People just don't know how and when to use them, and then you end up getting this issue where, as I was saying, the litigant with the highest likelihood of success is the one that throws the most money at it.
That's fantastic, Barry. Stephen wants to ask you a question, but before so, do you have a thing such as a barrow order in America?
Barry? Yes, the courts have the ability to award a party that is poor or a party that's abused money so that they could level the playing field. But the problem is that they rarely do that.
So the problem is that they rarely do that. I'm confident that the reason will be the same reason as it is here, that the lawyers who can successfully argue those sort of cases are the ones who take more money in the first place and won't even consider taking on a client who doesn't have money in the first place.
Actually, I think it's more that judges are really reluctant to order the wealthier party to pay more of it. In the first book that I wrote with Mohanna, we had a chapter by Judge Mike Brigner who talked about this, and he very much advocates for courts to level the playing field. And he was saying that the judges just are really reluctant to do it. It's such a rare thing for them to do that, they tend not to. It's like they're expecting and they're used to financial battles, and they don't understand that in a domestic violence case, it's the father's abuse that causes the unbalance, and that if the court doesn't balance the playing field, the outcome is going to be decided based on the disparity of money rather than based on the merits of the case.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's a bit different here. I don't think that judges are reluctant to award these sort of things. Lawyers really just don't apply for them. It's similar. There's a lot of tools that you can use as a lawyer, and many lawyers just don't because they don't know how to. They don't know. And, in fact, in many cases, it comes before a judge who's never actually sometimes seen the thing. You know what I mean? Like a pre-litigation discovery order is something that's available in our smallest court. But nobody ever goes for it. It's something that's in the court's rules, and you can do it, which allows you to get documents from the other party that you don't have before you actually go and take them to court. Anyway, wait, Steve, look, you've got a question.
Yes, Barry. We didn't have any parameters set for this interview. Do you have to leave us or anything like that?
No, I'm okay.
Okay. Yeah, we still have another 54 minutes to go with my show, so we can continue on. I was also just thinking, it wasn't really a question, it was more like a statement. I think people need to learn to sacrifice more, Barry, Jagdeep, Jillian. I think people need to think more about what it is going to happen to the child or children in a divorce. People need to put themselves maybe to the side when it does come to children, because I've said it before on quite a few shows, we're not really raising children, we're raising adults, and what affects them in their youth is only going to multiply in their later years.
You know, I think that's true, and again, we have to avoid treating it as if the mothers and fathers are both doing that. Because, you know, I remember being really frustrated over and over again. The judge would pontificate to both the mother and the father that, you know, you both brought the child into this world, and you have to cooperate and all that stuff, as if both are equally responsible in cases in which the father has a long pattern of abusive and coercive behavior, and the mother is just trying to protect herself and the child, and yet she's lumped in with his tactics. And that's a real error. You know, we need to understand that, you know, 90% of contested custody is domestic violence cases. And what we really ought to be doing early in the court proceeding is have a hearing just on the issue of domestic violence. Because if it's a domestic violence case, we know what to do. We need to give the mother custody, protect her from the father, and give the father accountability so that if he wants a relationship with the child, he has to stop his abuse. Instead, what the courts are doing is pressuring the mother to cooperate with her abuser, and if she refuses, they're punishing her, which is really punishing the children.
That's really important, and I'm really interested in that perspective, Barry, about the woman and the children's perspective. We've got a person in here who's calling you lawyers scumbags, and I really understand that, but I think that they actually fail to recognize, particularly with Barry. He is the least unscumbag person ever. Barry... Barry is so trained by women, it's not funny, aren't you, Barry?
No, I have had a wonderful experience of learning from a series of women, and first as on the board of a battered women's shelter, and then working in a batterer program where the director is one of the most brilliant women I've met, and then with Dr. Hanna, who I've, you know, written some books with and, you know, worked with in a variety of ways. And, you know, men can learn a lot if they listen to women. And, of course, it's not what we're trained to do. It's not what we're used to doing. And we're missing out on a lot.
That's absolutely so true. And
Jill.
Yes, Stephen.
And besides, Barry might agree with you that all, lawyers are scumbags because he's not a lawyer anymore.
and why is Barry not a lawyer? Because he stood up to a judge, a corrupt judge, and so the corrupt judge then turned around and said, you can't expose the fact I'm a corrupt judge.
Right.
I'll make you take a year off being a lawyer. That's more or less what happened, isn't it, Barry?
Yeah, and you know, that judge and some of his colleagues, you know, had developed a series of really biased and bad practices, and ultimately what happened was there were a series of domestic violence homicides in that small county where they controlled everything because of the mistreatment of women, and they had a county legislative committee investigate, and they found that women had stopped using the court system because it was so much helping abusers. And so he wound up getting exposed anyway.
Fantastic. So he got exposed. What happened after he got exposed?
Well, by that time, he actually resigned.
Well, goal achieved. Only to be replaced by someone else twice as corrupt, probably.
Now, maybe three quarters is corrupt.
Three quarters. Fair enough. Look, I don't think that lawyers are scumbags. I think there are scumbags amongst all of us in every occupation. And same as corruption. See, an interesting thing is my background is I'm from India, right, which is one of the most corrupt countries on the planet. But it's funny. You see, in India, a policeman stops you in your vehicle and pulls you over and says, show me your license, and you show him a 50-rupee note, and he says, okay, thank you, see you later. You know, basically, the corruption there is from the smallest level up to the highest level. In Western countries, it's really at the higher levels only, fortunately. Well, definitely in Australia. You know, government, big institutions, things like that. So basically, I guess we're better off, or maybe we're not, because you wake up with this false sense of, you know, this you're living in this world without corruption, compared to in India, you know what it is and you know how to deal with it from day naught. So, I mean, Barry, what do you think of the idea that corruption is something that is part of all of us a little bit as a society?
Well, I really think that, you know, it's an individual thing. You know, there are people that are corrupt and people that aren't. And I think sometimes, you know, we tend to use the term corruption too quickly. You know, I know that within the Battered Mothers movement, they constantly speak about corruption. And I understand why, because the way they've been mistreated looks like corruption, and sometimes it is, but more often it's about bias and it's about ignorance, and it's about a system that is just woefully broken. But it's hard to imagine something less than corruption could result in the just abominable outcomes that we see that destroy children's lives.
And this is a good segue back to the conference, Barry. So how's the conference going to cut? How's the conference in Washington Law University, University Law School going to cover some of these problems and be hopefully an important part of the transformation, only a part, but at least a step in the right direction, led by good men such as yourself?
Well, you know, we've been doing a lot of activism more and more as part of the conference and in addition to the conference. So we've been going to D.C. We've been doing demonstrations. There will be a demonstration in front of the White House on Mother's Day. The next day we're going to be lobbying in Congress, and we're trying to get oversight hearings to look at how some money is really being misspent on fatherhood initiatives. And you know, we're going to try to you know, get some of the reforms that we need in the United States. Child custody issues are reserved to the states, so the federal government only has limited ability to impact it. That, you know, they can give some grants to encourage some reforms. They can deny funds to states using particularly bad practices, but it's mostly a state issue. But, you know, we are trying to raise awareness of the problem, and, you know, so we will be doing that. The conference itself, one of the things we're going to be talking about is helping mothers to heal. And, you know, we have some of the few good mental health professionals who actually know about DV and who, you know, are really supportive of protecting mothers, who will be there and who will be speaking on the Saturday before Mother's Day. So, you know, I think it's a great time. And, you know, even aside from everything else that goes on, to see the mothers get together and support each other and to know that they're not alone, to talk about their cases. And, you know, what I keep hearing them say is, I think we're married to the same man, because it's the same tactics that are being used over and over again. And that helps them understand, both in their head and in their heart, that it had nothing to do with their behavior. It was solely about his mistreatment of them. And so that's an important thing for them to recognize.
That's really important. It's very, very important. I have a battered mother here with me at the moment, and she's actually been in tears at what you're saying, Barry. She just happened to arrive, and so this is why I actually don't have my earphones on at the moment, so she can listen. And she's saying just so many of the things that you say are true. And one of the biggest issues for her is feeling believed, being validated.
Mm-hmm. Well, if I could, I have a wonderful story about being believed that really is perhaps why I'm in this movement and why I'm doing this work. If you have a couple minutes, I'll share it with you.
I'd love it. I'd love it. And then we'll play Helen Reddy's song, I Am Woman, and then we'll keep on going. So tell the story first. We'd love to hear it. Thanks.
Many years ago, three children told their mother that their father was physically and sexually abusing them. And she immediately called Child Protective, got a protective order, sought custody, and the children were required to tell their story to the judge, to their law guardian, to the evaluator, and to the child protective caseworker. And as often happens in these cases, each of them assumed that the mother put them up to making false statements, and they threatened to take the children from the mother if she didn't stop. And so the children had been protected for a while, but then the judge ordered that they resume custody the next weekend. And before that could happen, the father was confronted by the family babysitter in the presence of the law guardian, and he admitted to kissing his daughters on their private. And the law guardian immediately made a motion to stop the visitation, which I supported. And the judge conferred with the evaluator, and the evaluator said, well, the father used bad judgment but there was no reason to stop the visitation. And during that first visitation, the four-year-old was penetrated for the first time. Well, I called and made a new report to Child Protective based on the father's new admissions. And when the judge heard, he yelled and screamed at me, "How dare you? They already investigated. They didn't find anything. Why are you doing this?" Well, the new caseworker did a more thorough investigation, found out that the father was doing much worse than we alleged, and they brought charges against the father, and he never again had anything but supervised visitation. And the mother won custody and invited the caseworker and me for a celebratory dinner. And the children had gifts for us, but most important, they had a name for us. And they called us believers because we believed them when all those professionals who were supposed to protect them didn't. And so I'm here to tell you that there is nothing better than being called a believer.
And Clarissa's crying again now. So do you want to play the song, Stephen?
Yeah, I have to find it here. Hang on a second. Okay.
That's a very important story. Sorry, Stephen.
No, you're okay. I just got to get it all set up.
Yeah, well, that is the most important thing. You know, Eve, the power of healing in psychology and psychiatry and absolutely everywhere is people believing that your story, And so often this is what happens. Little children tell their story and the parents won't believe them. The women tell their story and their families won't believe them. People go to the courts and tell the courts their story and they don't believe them. And it's really hard to be believed because people, it's a very complicated reason why we can't be believed. But I think the most important thing is to keep our strength and keep repeating our truth for women who are in these situations.
Okay, Jill, I'm ready.
Okay, let's go. So welcome back to People's Internet Radio. Thank you. We're on Stephen Roberts' show. Stephen Roberts, thank you so much for having this very exciting show.
That song's not going to get played again, Jill.
Well, look, you know, it's really important. You know, we could also have a similar song that says, "I am man." Hey, right? But it is important to go on what?
Are you kidding? The feminists would burn the world down.
Well, that's mislabeling feminism because true feminism, according to I, who am only just starting to understand it, because I've always been into people's liberation, not women's liberation.
And how many are stereotypical?
I beg your pardon?
How many of them are the stereotypical, what are characterized as Nazis?
Yeah, well, that's right, and that's a patriarchal, masculine attitude that's been adopted by the women because they've internalized the oppressor. But true feminism is recognizing that there's a binary, that there's me and not me. And when you get into that selfish mode of just me and not me, then that's what feminism or Lucy Irigaray and some of the great feminists are arguing, that we actually are functioning on a patriarchal binary that's been in our society for a very long time. And so it's like these, what I call the boot scooting lesbians. You know, you get these women who are really sort of feminist lesbians, but they dress up like men and they pierce and tattoo everything and put on their boots and shave their head off and turn into the ugliest man you ever did see.
But you know, it always hasn't been a patriarchal led societies though, Joe. There's been suppressed science out there that shows that women were actually in charge many thousands of years ago.
That's right, but we're dealing with now, aren't we? We're dealing with the society of today, and we're trying to address some of the problems of today.
As far as I'm concerned, Jill, women are still in the power. They just don't know it, and they have forgotten how. Feminism has trained women to be non-reliant on men, and they've given their power away.
Barry, I think you're the expert here, and I think it's time to comment.
Well, I mean, the fact is that men have all sorts of unearned privileges in virtually every society, and there's a long history of that. And again, there's this tendency to create a false equivalency. We have a long way to go, before women would have the same privileges and opportunities that men have. And, again, this is an example of men are often unconscious of our unearned privileges.
Don't everyone
come on, man. You have the privilege to speak now. Say something.
I was going to say, don't everyone jump up there at once. What is it? What's the appearances of this direction that we're heading in the Sikh Indian society, Jagdeep?
Well, the Sikh gurus were around, say, 500 odd years ago to 300 years ago, which was a time where in India things like sati existed, and sati is the cultural thing where if a man dies, the woman is thrown onto the funeral pyre and killed. And in fact, to the point where that practice was accepted, to the point where the woman would throw herself on and commit suicide because it was the thing to do. Now, where did that come from? Well, basically it came from this problem of society not accepting widowed ladies. And to be honest, where did that come from? It came from the fact that whether you are married or not, you still have a sexual desire, and if you're going to have sex and you're not married, that's a problem. Therefore, if you're a widow and you're going to remarry, how do you have sex with community still accepting it, et cetera, et cetera?
A sin's a sin, even in India,
Exactly,
India, right?
And then what happens is people say, well, it's just better off if you die or if you're killed, then everyone's we don't have to deal with that issue. Now, at that time,
better to die than not be able to have sex, you reckon, Jack?
No. Sikhism comes along and says society, how on earth did we come up with this? This is stupid. This is silly. Why can't she just remarry and then it's all good? And that sort of thing. So we prohibit things like sati, which were very widely practiced, very widely practiced things in the Indian community, non-Sikh. And even up until the British came into India, which was really not that long ago. And the whole heap of stories, based on that and all this sort of thing, basically at that time, the Sikh gurus come into that sort of an environment or that sort of a society, and they see people bowing before the king. And I mean, the king comes and they throw themselves down. You are higher than me. And they say, why then call the woman bad who gave birth to the king? So it's just putting a logical spin on, well, spin, no spin, but, looking at it logically how
can something good give birth to something bad?
No. Saying that you're bowing before the creation, and yet you call the creator bad. Do you know what I mean? So this is the issue there, and Sikhism turns around and says, no, this is wrong. You can't call a woman bad, and you can't look down on her. This is you were born from a woman. You were made. The first thing you consumed came from part of a woman. You grow up. You fall in love with a woman. You marry a woman. And, your whole life revolves around women. And then here you go treating them in a way which is not equal to men. It's illogical. It's nonsensical. And therefore, Sikhism says that it's wrong. So basically, the Sikh spin on it is that, you know, gender equality, and I really do mean equality, is important. Anything that a man can do in society, a woman can do. Now, obviously, I'm not talking about childbirth. That is a physical restriction, or, you know, that's the difference between a man and a woman, and there's nothing wrong with having different roles, you know, in a relationship or in a family setting or even in a community. But in terms of things like, okay, we don't have any clergy, for example. We don't have any priests at all in Sikhism. Any Sikh can perform any ritualistic function like, you know, a marriage ceremony, funeral rites, child naming ceremony, initiation ceremonies, and men and women can do that equally. Now, that is the theology, that is the philosophy, that is the ideology. The practice, unfortunately, is not exactly that strong.
You want to know what I've noticed as a radio host, and that is that men can just talk on and on and on and on and on about their point. Yeah. Like, men don't seem to talk in short sentences like women do.
Now, be nice. Well, listen.
Yeah, and so, I want to get back to Barry. Finish the concept.
Marriage is not a short sentence.
Barry's the star of the show.
Go on. Barry.
Yes.
You're talking about, what was it, a false... False equivalency. Now, is that like saying men have to be the same as women and not understanding that men are actually different from women and women are actually different from men, but they can still be equal?
Well, you know, to treat people the same when they're different is not something that's fair.
Yeah. So your notion of a false equivalency is arbitrarily saying, okay, we must treat everyone exactly the same, and that's the way we're going to be fair and equal.
Right. I mean, we're saying that's a mistake. And, you know, on the surface, it seems fair, but in practice, it's not. And, you know, I don't know when we would ever get to the point where men and women have the same privileges, but certainly that's what we should be aiming for. And I think we need to be much more aware of all the unearned advantages that men have. And, you know, another word for men's privileges is life. You know, it's just the way it is in so many societies, so that, you know, we're oblivious to it. And it's safe for men to be oblivious. It's not safe for women.
Yeah, no, sorry to shut you up so hard, Jag, but I'm not meaning to shut you up. I'm just meaning to lead to Barry, because he really does understand a lot about feminism that I want to get out of him. And I understand, you know, the importance of explaining the Sikh perspective. But I want to get back, because we've only got 20 minutes left, believe it or not. Time flies when you're having fun, to the conference. So we're talking about women healing. I think it's fairly well established.
I got a question, Carol.
Yeah, go on.
Barry, what do you think the best scenario, what do you think the best outcome could be at this conference?
Well, hopefully we raise awareness. It would be nice if we get some coverage. You know, last year, which was the 10th anniversary of the Battered Mothers Conference, the Washington Post, which is, you know, maybe the second leading paper in the country, did an editorial about the Battered Mothers Conference, you know, and we've never had anything like that, and that was really wonderful. You know, so if we can raise awareness of the issues some more, that would be really helpful. If we could get Congress to have oversight hearings. That would be great. And the other thing, which we haven't talked about tonight that we're going to try to talk about, is the Quincy model, which is going to be what my next book is about. And, you know, maybe some of your listeners would be interested in sharing $500 billion, because that's the amount of money we can save by drastically reducing domestic violence.
A half a trillion?
Yes.
Yeah.
Every year.
What areas would that... you're obviously talking about tax money, right? Aren't you?
Some is tax money, but the biggest saving is in healthcare costs. Because we said before that children exposed to domestic violence, child abuse, et cetera, have more illnesses and injuries throughout their lives. The same thing is true about battered women. So that one of the biggest savings is in reduced healthcare costs. So that impacts health insurance premiums. In the United States, it would impact Medicare and Medicaid, payment to government employees. All of those things would be a saving. And what would also happen is if employers could pay less for health insurance because there's less illnesses, they could pay more on wages. So all of that would be helpful. Another big saving is in crime, because even aside from all the domestic violence crimes that we deal with, children who witness domestic violence are more likely to commit other types of crimes when they grow up. So reducing domestic violence will reduce all crimes. And the other big financial benefit is that women and children and abusers often have their economic potential lost because of domestic violence. So if everybody could reach their economic potential, that's going to improve the economies and generate a lot more income that we'll all share. And what's interesting about this is that it's not just the immediate victim who's losing out, it's all of society. And if we knew that, it would create much more demand to make the reforms. You know, in the United States, that $500 billion, that comes to about $1,500 a person. So why should I pay $1,500 for some jerk down the block to hit his wife?
Yes, absolutely. And Barry, we need to say goodbye to Jagdeep. He has a meeting he has to go to. So have a good day over there, Jagdeep.
Thank you very much for having me, guys. Barry, you've been a great wealth of knowledge.
I've learned a lot. Nice talking to you.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming, Jag. It was lovely to see you. I look forward to seeing you.
Thanks, Stephen.
Good luck.
See you all.
Yes. Yes.
And I'm listening.
Okay.
Okay.
All right, bye.
So what you're saying, actually, Barry, is a form of economic rationalism. But, I mean, I really think that it's an important economic rationalism. What do you have to say? What do you think about me calling it an economic rationalism? I mean, it's a shame we have to resort to economic rationalism over such a thing as domestic violence. But, yes, people may listen to that. They're not listening to other things, so it seems.
I mean, I've seen the stories. I would gladly pay a substantial amount of money so that women and children could live their lives safe in their homes. And when I discovered in the research that, in fact, not only do we not have to pay money to do it, but we would save a huge amount of money, there's no justification for continuing to tolerate men's abuse of women. I mean, essentially what the governments are doing, and that's true in the United States and it's true in Australia and everywhere else, is we are really paying a subsidy to abusers to allow them and to tolerate their abuse. And that's crazy that we do that.
I sort of missed it there. What do you mean we're paying a subsidy to abusers to tolerate their abuse?
Well, all of us, you know, pay money whether it's for health care, whether it's for taxes, you know, whether it's in the form of a weaker economy, because of the enormous harm that abusers are doing not only to their partner and to their children, but to all of society. And that really creates a whole new way of looking at domestic violence, because, of course, there was a long history of treating domestic violence as if it was a private matter. And when we understand that it impacts everyone, whether they're a direct victim or not, it creates a very different discussion.
Yes, it does. It does. It creates a very different discussion. And any way at which we can approach this problem, the better. And that's not leaving out, and I know we're not intentionally doing that, and I know statistically that women are the victims of abuse more, and there's many reasons for that. Men have more powerful, a lot of power in a lot of different ways. But that, we, you know, and I've had this conversation with you before, Barry, because there are women who do abuse their husbands more than the husband abuses the wife. And we can't forget that, and we don't want it to be too sort of biased in the one direction. Would you like to have a, what do you think about that, Barry?
Well, I have a little bit different perspective. You know, certainly there are women who mistreat men, who assault men. Certainly that happens, although way less frequently than when men do it. I would not use the term abuse, because what women do to men is fundamentally different than what men do to women, because there is a long history and there is a continuing societal benefit that men have. So men are doing it from a position of power and privilege, whereas women are doing it from a position of disadvantage. And so it makes it different. It doesn't make it acceptable. I mean, women should not be hitting or hurting men, and, you know, if they do, they should be held accountable just as men should be. But there's this tendency to, you know, talk about, well, what about the women? In the batterer classes that I teach, that's what they want to talk about. What about the women? Well, you know, domestic violence is overwhelmingly something that men do to women, and that's what we need to concentrate on. And certainly the rare times when the man is a victim, he should be helped and supported and all of that, and there's no excuse for that. But let's focus on what the real problem is, which is overwhelmingly something that men are doing to women and have done to women for a very long period of time. You know, there is a long history of society allowing and even encouraging husbands to abuse their wives. There's no equivalent on the other side. You know, the first domestic violence law in the United States was that it said that husbands may not beat their wives on Sunday, which meant that any other day, society allowed men or husbands to beat their wives. You know, you probably are familiar with the rule of thumb.
Yeah, well, which, you know, that was also
said that a husband can't assault their wives with an object thicker than their thumb.
Yeah.
So again, there's this long history of society and government saying it's okay for husbands to assault their wives. There's no equivalent on the other side. We never said it was okay for wives to do that to husbands. So it makes domestic violence very different. It's a gendered crime, and to try to treat it as if it's both men and women really, you know, distorts the issue.
I think it's a lot more taboo for men to even think about admitting that they've been abused by women.
Actually, the opposite. Men are much more likely to make deliberately false allegations lots of times to try to undermine her complaints about his abuse.
Okay. Yeah, you are speaking about a false allegation, though, but something that happens to be true. I would think it would be a lot more taboo for a man to approach that situation there, if true.
I've heard that a lot. I don't necessarily believe it. I mean, I'm sure that there are some individual men who were embarrassed to say what the wife or the girlfriend did.
That's I don't know. That's a pretty good debate subject there, Barry. But takes a lot of men, or it takes a lot more courage for a man or a boy to admit that he's been raped by another man.
Well, that's a different issue because that goes into heterosexism.
Okay. Jill, you got a comment here, or?
Well, look, we've only got 10 minutes left to go, and I was actually wondering if there
Do you want your young woman friend there to ask a question or anything like that?
She's shaking her head.
I guess that means no, huh?
I guess that means no. I do have a comment. My comment is, look, I know what you're saying. I understand the umbrella under which you placed it, Barry, and I agree with that umbrella. I was thinking about psychological violence and things like that, I suppose, and that you're actually have been in women's refuges and your contact, the interface for you has been where women have suffered horrendous abuse. And it is very unequal in terms of how hard a man can hit, and when men do have the financial power, how strongly a man can withhold that money. And you do see it, like you said, it does seem like the same story again and again and again. You know, everybody's saying, "But that's my story." It sounds as though we're talking about the same man.
Yeah, I mean, we train men in most societies to be aggressive, to be violent. I mean, even aside from domestic violence, most physical crimes are committed by men, more often against other men. But it's part of the training. You know, in this country where we've had all these mass murders, we rarely focus on the fact that 98-99% of them are committed by men or boys. You know, what does that say, that it's so overwhelmingly something that men do? You know, we really ought to be focusing on that, because it really says something about our society is wrong.
Well,
I agree. Now, Barry,
a lot of things are wrong.
Go on, Steve.
A lot of things are very wrong, yes. But go ahead, Jill.
Yeah, no, it's really true. No, well, I'm actually wanting Barry... because Barry and I had, some pre-show conversations, and we talked about the story of the goats. I'm wondering if it fits in now, because I have Fitzy and Whipper's goat song here. And I sort of wanted to see if we could fit Fitzy and Whipper's goat song into this show, but I don't know how well it'll fit. What do you think, Barry?
Well, let me just tell you what happened with the goats, because we've been having a lot of fun with goats. And what happened was, the last time we were in D.C., for some lobbying and some rallies, was when the American government was shut down. And shortly before it was shut down, some of our national parks were having a major problem with poison ivy and was overgrowing to such an extent that it couldn't be eliminated by normal means. And someone had a really great idea that they would bring in goats, because goats like to eat poison ivy. As a matter of fact, one of the papers said it's sort of like a salad bar for goats. And so the goats were brought in, and they were eating the poison ivy, and the kids would wander around, and the people in the park would play with them. And it was just a wonderful situation. And then the fools in Congress decided to shut down the government, and the goats had to be returned home, deprived of their poison ivy. And we felt really bad about, what was done to the goats, by the people in Congress. And it really became almost like our mascots, because here we are trying to protect children, and goats really try to protect their kids. So it was a natural symbolism, and it was also sort of a lot of fun. We created the Goat Protection Society because we figured Congress needed a GPS because they had lost their way. And so we started talking about the goats, and we've had a lot of fun since then. And if you think about what we're talking about and all the horrendous stories in the custody courts and how women and children are being mistreated, it's good to be able to laugh a little bit and smile a little bit, and that's what the goats have brought for us.
Look, I think the goat story is a fantastic story, and as you know, there's so many, and the Kaylee story is a wonderful story, and I think it's so important, you know, because we can get so scared and we can become so crouchy and we can lose our sense of balance over this, and when we lose our sense of balance, which we get by having a sense of humor and taking things lightly, even in the midst of horrendous stress, then our mind can get breach homeostasis, and we can think more clearly and work out what to do next again.
I'm sorry, I missed.
Pardon?
I missed what you said.
What I'm saying is, I think it's very important that homeostasis. You know, the everything in nature has a mechanism that makes us want to reach a point of equilibrium again. And so what I'm saying is, I think I love the way, Barry, that you make so many jokes, even though today it hasn't been a very jokey day. But I think it's really important, you know, for people to make the sort of jokes that you do make off air.
Yes, I think it's important to be able to laugh. And, you know, the other thing is, a lot of our jokes in this society put people down in ways that are really offensive. And if you're doing the kind of work I'm doing to try to end depression, to try to protect women and children, it's important not to do that with jokes. So being able to joke about dolphins and goats in a very loving way, you know, I think is a helpful thing and really a healing thing.
Say, Barry,
yep.
I have just one last question. I don't know if Jill has anything after this, but you're going to be able to get your your law practice back? You got to be able to get your license back?
No, I'm not going back. I'm going to stay being a nice guy.
Oh, okay.
I'm working full time. You know, as a writer, as a speaker, as an advocate, I am very excited about my next book about the Quincy model. I'm hoping that that's going to change everything. And, you know, because when people learn that not only can they protect women and children, but that they can share $500 billion, I think there's going to be a lot of excitement about that. And it's new information that they're not getting anywhere else, and so I'm hoping that this book is really going to make a difference.
Sure. Go ahead and tell us the name of the book again, and maybe your other books, too, and tell us where we can get them.
Okay. What you might want to try doing is going to my website, which is barrygoldstein.net. It has a variety of articles I've written. It has links to the books, which include Scared to Leave, Afraid to Stay, Representing the Domestic Violence Survivor, and Domestic Violence, Abuse, and Child Custody. And it also talks about the consulting and expert witnessing work that I do. So that's a good place to get a lot of information. You know, hopefully soon we will be expanding the work that we're doing. And I'm going to be doing a lot of traveling around the country, speaking about the Quincy model. The National Coalition Against Domestic Violence would like to create a Quincy campaign to bring this all over the country. And, you know, you may want to do that in Australia. I mean, they certainly would like to save money and stop domestic violence. And So we're going to show you how to do that.
Well, if you can, this has been so lovely to have you, Barry. And would you like to tell everyone about the conference one more time, please?
The Battle Brothers Conference is May 9th to 11th. And there's a website, thebatteredmothersconference.org. Hope your listeners will take a look at the schedule and our plans. I hope to see many of my friends there.
Okay. Oh, absolutely fabulous. Well, Barry Goldstein, thank you and so much. And Stephen Roberts, thank
yes.
you for having me on your show and giving me such a big part in it.
Yes, 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 yes. Thanks for coming on, Barry.
Okay, Kaylee is waving goodbye.
Goodbye, Kaylee. And if only you guys could love your
children,
wives and children as much as this next man loves his goat. We'll see what happens.
And the dolphin too, Jill.
And the dolphin too. But you wait till you hear the song, Stephen. It's
okay.
Insane.
All right. Very I'm going to put it on now.
Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Thanks, Barry.
Okay, bye now.